Press Conference USA. The Voice of America brings you Press Conference USA, an unrehearsed discussion program where correspondents question leading personalities in the news. This week's program originated in Houston, Texas, and our guests are the flight director for the Gemini space program and the flight surgeon for the Gemini 4 flight. To introduce our guests and the correspondents who will question them, here is Rhett Turner, the moderator of Press Conference USA.
Today on Press Conference USA, it's our pleasure to have the flight director for the Gemini program, Mr. Christopher Kraft, and the flight surgeon for the U.S. manned spacecraft effort, Dr. Charles Berry. With us to interview Mr. Kraft and Dr. Berry are Henry Simmons of Newsweek magazine and Mr. Adalbert Beerwulf of Die Welt in West Germany. For our first question, may I turn to Mr. Beerwulf?
Well, I have a question to Dr. Berry. I think what I feel is most interesting to me is the effect that the two astronauts have confirmed what astronaut Cooper saw earlier, being able to see so many, identify so many things on the ground. And after the Cooper flight, many scientists jumped to their feet and said, well, this is all against the laws of optics. And what is your comment, Dr. Berry?
Well, I think that there was a great hue and cry after Gordon's flight, and there was a fair amount of study done about this, about what you can see. And it's surprising, if you look at it strictly from an optical point of view, just straight optics, you can see a very small area, and you can show that you can see something as small as a runway width. Now, there's still some argument about exactly how wide something has to be in order to resolve it from that altitude. And we hope to get some more information about this during the Gemini program. We have some specific sized ground targets that are going to be set out here in West Texas and in Western Australia. And these will be observed from flight. In fact, on the next mission, this is going to be done. And we will be able to get some specific information then on this subject. Now, I think Ed saw a number of things which are obviously he could do with cues. And you remember he was pretty careful today to say, for instance, he didn't see ships, he saw the wakes of ships. And I think this is the thing you have to remember, that all of our visual processes are not just a simple matter of optics. We use our brains to interpret some of the cues that we get. And contrast is a terribly important thing. And if in some of the areas, particularly in northern Africa, where there was some desert areas, it was very easy to see things because of the contrast with that type of a background.
But White said he could see more than actually out of an airplane and
40,000 feet. That's right.
It's really surprising.
It is surprising.
Readily obvious from the film. You were able to see from the film how clear the ground was from in those pictures. And we didn't have a filter on that film or anything else. It was just taken straight out the window.
Mr. Simmons?
Mr. Kraft, you've had a rugged 4 days keeping on top of this flight. And I would like to ask you what are the chief things we've learned from this 4-day mission from the standpoint of being able to operate in space?
Well, certainly the most important thing was that we could get four men up there. They could live in that very confined space of the spacecraft, that the spacecraft systems would support them for that length of time, and obviously for a much longer length of time. We didn't have some of the problems that we expected to have. In particular, the environmental control system, we expected to have problems with moisture because we had run in a vacuum chamber and found large amounts of water at the end of the particular period of time we were dealing with. So certainly the spacecraft systems are ready to handle the type of operations that we are planning in the Gemini program. The fact that the men could do the experiments, they could stuff this thing full of equipment and then get it out and use it, was also another fact which we got out of it as by the press conference the men described today. We also found that we have a new mission control center here in Houston that is a tremendous tool in our being able to conduct these spaceflight operations, because as you saw by the rendezvous attempt we made, when you start trying to do this rendezvous by simple optical means, and in this case we had no optical aids, just his eyes, that it was an extremely difficult task to carry out. And we have known this for some time, that whenever you get very far away from an object in space, it's going to be very difficult to rendezvous with it again because of the judgment of distances and the total mechanical problems, or the orbital mechanics problems that you run into. So these computers that we have on the ground here in the Mission Control Center are an absolute must to carrying out these complex operations. So I think we've set ourselves up now that we know we can conduct these space operations, and I think the things that we do in the future will be an expansion on this kind of work, and I think you'll see a lot of things happening from us.
Well, then, in short, what you say is that in the Mercury program, we were operating with little stabs in space, but now we're all set to roll in a much bigger way, in more dimensions than we were capable of.
There's no question about it. That's what we set out to do with the Gemini program. Many people have criticized the Gemini program in that we weren't using the same hardware, for instance, that we're using in Apollo. But we developed the Gemini spacecraft on the basis of equipment that we had developed while we were developing the Mercury spacecraft. We've gotten the state of the art that was coming along into our spacecrafts now, and now we are able to get some spacecraft operational experience, which is absolutely a must to the Apollo program, even though we don't have the same hardware. So it's the operational aspects of it in every sense, not only the control of the trajectory, but the man-machine relationships, the aeromedical problems, all of those things we're trying to get out of the Gemini program, which will then make the Apollo program one of dealing then with purely the Apollo systems themselves and perfecting our operation to the lunar landing.
I might explain for our listeners overseas that the Gemini program is an interim one that will then go on into Project Apollo, to which Mr. Kraft refers, which is the moon landing program. May I ask this question in reference to a human being's ability to determine distance in space when out in this environment? Dr. Barry, I wonder if you have done studies on the references needed for human beings in determining distance and speed. What's the psychology of that?
Well, that's a field that's been fairly well examined here on Earth. The difficulty is to take this information and relate it to the space environment. And there has been a feeling, as you know, for a number of years, that when you were in space, you would have difficulty focusing on any particular object, and a condition which was called space myopia, or nearsightedness, resulting just from the fact that you didn't have anything to focus on, would result. This has not been shown to be the case, as a matter of fact, and that you almost always have something that you can focus on, whether it be a star or what have you. You have some object that will draw your line of sight. If you're looking into a complete empty field where there's nothing at all, this is true, you will produce a myopia. But you have to have something that you can use as a cue, like you remember he talked today about, Jim talked today in the press conference.
This was in the press conference on Friday.
That's right, about the lights on the booster. And the fact that we had two lights on this booster, and this, if he could judge the distance between these lights, this would give him some cue to distance in space, which is true. You have to have two things at least to give you a good clue to distance. And it's helpful if you have these two things that are at an angle to each other, and you can judge distance that way, of course. And if he can aim for one, if he could aim for one thing and had something out here that he could use as he moved and changed his angle with that, he can get depth perception that way then, far better than if he's just trying to do it with a single object.
Do you feel that you've really cut through several unknowns in this flight?
I think a fair number of these, Red. I think the first one that we noted in the flight was this vertigo idea with being out in open space, the idea that you would not be able to orient yourself, that you would develop disorientation and indeed probably become sick from this. We did not observe any of this, and I think anyone who has seen the films that were taken on this during this event will be impressed with the amount of motion that went on. It wasn't certainly a completely stable thing. He was moving all the time and in various positions, and there certainly was no evidence whatsoever of any type of vertigo, and this was a very heartening thing. I think you have to, this always remind, I thought many times when we were out on the carrier talking about this, that I remember the test that we devised early in the Mercury program where we had the astronaut hold his head in a certain position, and then we had him turn his head in certain positions to try and produce this. And I thought, gee, what a long ways we've come from that point, where we have a guy completely outside the spacecraft, and we're not worrying what he's moving in what direction at all.
Well, we might ask you both this, you from a medical viewpoint and Mr. Kraft from the technological viewpoint. Do you feel that you used Mercury experiences in training men to be in better condition for this type of flight, for the Gemini flight?
Well, I think the reason you find that each one of our pilots gets better and each one of our flights is more successful in carrying out our objectives is that we learn from each one of these flights. That's the reason we're doing the program. That's the reason we're gaining these operational experience. If you'll beg your, I'd like to beg your pardon and get back to some, talk about this rendezvous a little bit. I think that there's been a misconception that we didn't expect that the things that happened in that first orbit were going to happen, and it was a complete surprise to us, and that's further from, nothing could be further from the truth. We knew that in order to do a rendezvous with another vehicle that you had to have range and range rate in the terminal phase. We knew that you were going to have to track the other vehicle. We knew that it was going to take all of this very complicated computers on the ground in order to figure this thing out. It was not something that was unknown to us. What happened was that the launch vehicle got further away during that early phase of the flight. That is, the first couple of minutes there, the separation distances were greater than we had hoped for, and from that point on, it was in a very difficult, complex orbital mechanics problem that can only be done with instruments and ground computers.
Which you had not planned for this flight.
Exactly. And we had hoped to stay very close to this launch vehicle right from the beginning, and once we got separated from it, then to do it completely optically was pretty close to being impossible.
Mr. Beowulf.
Well, I'd like to come back to the medical aspect. There has been a lot of talk about the horrors of weightlessness. In fact, a Belgian professor has predicted that a man would not live longer than 5 days in space. Now, he has not been disproven so far. I think the Soviet cosmonaut Baikovsky went 119 hours and 92 hours in this flight. What is your attitude, Doctor?
Well, Mr. Beowulf, I feel very strongly at the present time, far stronger than I felt a week ago, as a matter of fact, that we certainly are going to, that man can do this and can perform in the spaceflight environment and do it very well for a period considerably longer than 5 days. I don't know what this period is right now, but I know he can do well for 4 days with a remarkable amount, a remarkable little bit of physiological deficit to look at post-flight. And I think that we need to have another step here where we can approximately double the experience that we have, and I think we'll do that, and I think we'll go on and be able to do 14 days in this spacecraft.
Are you going to, I mean, in Gemini 5, you're going 7 or 8 days possibly?
I think we may even go open-ended,
yeah,
Mr. Beowulf.
I think that Dr. Barry and I would like to recall that if we had listened to all the inputs we had previous to this flight, and I don't mean only from people outside the program, I mean people inside the program, we would have never let these two men fly. And you've got to listen to some of these inputs and take everything you hear with a little grain of salt. Man has great capabilities in overcoming the situation and adapting to a new environment. That's been shown all along. And I think we had faith in man's capability. Very good.
I think you have to have this faith. And I've said many times, and I think Chris and I are both this way, we tend to be optimistic about man's capabilities. And I don't mean just optimism, unfounded optimism. It's optimism based on observation and experience with this area. And we honestly have to evaluate a lot of people ideas who I don't think they're really trying to scare the whole program away or anything. It's just that they have some legitimate concern based on some little area that they're looking at. And you have to try and put these in proper perspective constantly. It happens every day to us.
Mr. Kraft, you mentioned a moment ago that we might even go open-ended with our next Gemini flight. Would you tell us what that means, and also tell us what you're going to do on the next flight? Give us some idea of what you have in mind, and also how you expect to profit from what we've learned on this flight.
Well, I think that Chuck would agree with me that certainly he was able this time to get a very good feel for the condition of those pilots while in flight. We've gained a great deal of experience in the rest cycles that they probably ought to do, the eating habits, the drinking habits. And I think it's very possible that as we go along in GT-7 that we will be able to make better judgment this time from the ground and have better confidence in the what we're seeing on the ground as the flight progresses than we did in the Gemini 4 flight.
And pardon me, by GT-7 you meant the flight 3 forward from this time?
No, I beg your pardon, I meant the GT-5 flight.
The next
if I
flight.
Said 7. We have the forces set up to handle a flight on an open-ended basis every time we've flown. We had that situation in Gemini 4. And I think that we will give consideration to that sort of thing as we go. Now, I think Chuck will probably not want to go more than 7 or 8 days. That may be true. But I don't think that we ought to say exactly what we're going to do in this flight. We ought to do it on the basis of being able to see how it goes from the beginning.
That's what you call real-time flight planning, then.
Exactly, and I think that that we've talked about it until you probably have gotten tired of hearing it, that the pilots came back themselves and stressed the fact that after the first 5 minutes, they might as well have thrown the flight plan that they had away, that all they really needed was a list of the experiments that they were going to do and familiarity with them, and then cooperation from them and the ground to figure out what we were going to do next.
Gentlemen, we'll have more questions in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA from the Voice of America in Washington. This is Rhett Turner reporting from Houston with Mr. Christopher Kraft, the Flight Operations Director of the U.S. Manned Space Program, the Project Gemini Flight Number 4, which was just completed, and Dr. Charles Berry, the flight surgeon for the Gemini 4 flight. Our panel is Mr. Henry Simmons of Newsweek magazine and Mr. Adelbert Beowulf of Die Welt in West Germany. For more questions, may I turn to you now, Mr. Beowulf.
Mr. Kraft, most of the people, of course, watching these exciting space flights think it must be very dangerous sitting on top of one of those rockets. And I've noticed then that during the Gemini mission, you have driven away from the full automatic system you have been using during the Mercury system. And this is the first step to give the astronauts more freedom of action during the power flight portion of the flight.
Well, I think that's a long way off. I think the business of having the astronauts actually control the thrust and guide the launch vehicle is a long way off because of the closeness of the payload. That is, the amount of payload that we carry, we're very limited in the amount of weight we can lift, and therefore we cannot afford the control systems necessary to give them that action, nor can we afford the inaccuracies that would result. The guidance systems that we have guiding the Titan launch vehicle and our future vehicles are very, very accurate, and they have to be to take advantage of all its thrust capability so we can get the optimum payload into orbit. Therefore, I think that the time when the astronauts will actually control the thrust during powered flight is a long way off. I don't think it's in the next 10 years.
I was thinking more about abort, controlling the abort.
Well, unquestionably, they are in the best, have always been in the best position to evaluate the situation in terms of catastrophic failures on the launch vehicle. There's no point in trying to interpret that stuff through complicated electronic gear. Man is an excellent computer himself, and he can interpret the data. And when you want to change the gain that you're looking at, that is, if you want to abort at 10 degrees per second halfway through the flight rather than 5 degrees, he just flips his computer himself and says to a mind, okay, the limits are now 10 instead of 5. So you don't have to build that into a piece of electronic gear. You certainly want to take advantage of man's flexibility there. On the other hand, if all it takes is a switch, that is, when you get to a certain point and you want to throw a switch, you also don't want to give the man that mundane task. You want to take advantage of his capabilities. You don't want to tie him down, nor wait him over in that sort of thing. Now, this has got to be a trade-off in the design of our spacecraft. We want to give them automatic systems which prevent them from having to do these menial tasks while they're in orbit so they can do meaningful things, do experiments, etc. So it's a trade-off. It's just like an autopilot in a transport airplane. The pilot is there to fly it, but when he's flying across the country at a constant altitude of 31,000 feet in a jetliner, he turns on the autopilot, and the astronauts want to do the same thing.
Mr. Simmons?
Mr. Kraft, you've told us that you didn't feel any concern about the safety of the astronauts at any time during the flight. However, at the press conference, Ed White confessed, I believe he confessed, that his pulse rate hit its peak of 178 when he found that the lever to his hatch was just turning loosely in his hand. And I rather gathered from that he felt concern about being able to close the hatch and seal it properly. Would you comment on that one detail of this flight?
Well, I have to comment in two ways. In the first place, we weren't in contact with them on the ground when they were going through that hair-raising part of the flight, so we didn't have time to be concerned. And when we were back in contact with them again, they had the hatch closed and the cabin pressurized. And I've said many times since then, it was probably a good thing that we were not in contact with them at that moment, because all we would have done is bothered them in trying to find out what was going on as a result of the situation. They didn't have to worry about telling us on the ground. They just go ahead and do the work. Now, I think that they explained themselves in the press conference that they were prepared for any eventuality with that hatch. They had had a similar type experience at McDonnell, as a matter of fact, in the vacuum chamber. They had a similar experience where they couldn't get the hatch closed and had to go through this mechanical means. You have to recognize also that McDivitt said at the press conference that they had actually completely disassembled that hatch, and they knew every piece of hardware that was in it, every gear, every pin, every ratchet. They knew how to put it back together again, and they knew how to fix that hatch. So I agree with you, Henry. If I had known that that was going on, my heartbeat would probably also have been 178, but fortunately we didn't, and they got it closed very well.
Well, I have a personal question here, and this is about Christopher Kraft and Charles Berry, who seem to be another Gemini pair of twins in the way you two gentlemen operate. How do you reflect on the engineer versus, or together with, the doctor? Would you both answer that, Dr. Berry?
Well, that's a very interesting question, which I guess we've all wondered about at times, and it seems in the business of aerospace medicine and back in aviation medicine, there's always been some difficulty of getting together with the engineer between the medical people. It seems like we're always in the position of trying to set limits which seem to be out of context with what the engineer's capability is with the machine, and they feel that we're unnecessarily limiting the activity of their handiwork by this method. And I think in many cases, rightfully so. I think that you have to develop an attitude whereby you mutually accept each other for the inputs that you can have, and you both have the overall good of the program and the crew at heart. And once you have this sort of a relationship, and you know that you have, from the medical point of view, you're not being unreasonable with the demands, then I think you have a very, very fine attitude for getting work done like we're doing here. I think that's one of the amazing things about Chris and about many of the people in the program is, and it's been particularly so, I don't know of a guy in the world that I could get along as well with and think as much of as I do of Chris in this area, because of the things that he, the way that he can make decisions and evaluate the input from a medical side at a very critical time. And on my half, I try and make that as simple and direct and timely as I can.
Mr. Kraft?
Well, it's very little for me to say after that. I think
you're the engineer.
Well, yes, but really in a position that I have found myself both in the Mercury and the Gemini program is one of being pretty close to Solomon in trying to cut the baby, because you find that the engineer, as Chuck has pointed out, as Dr. Berry has pointed out, that they don't understand the medical people and the limits they put on the spacecraft. And I have to try to deliberate between these people and come up with something that I think is a reasonable mission rule to govern the flight. I would like to point out, however, that even you can make all the rules you want about how to fly these things, what the heartbeat should be, and what the man's temperature should be, and what his suit should read, and how comfortable he ought to be. But it isn't until you get up there and experience some of these things. Dr. Berry and I have a very close rapport, and I think that's necessary to making the decisions that are real-time decisions in a flight. We understand each other's problems. He understands the problems that we're faced with in having to make real quick decisions. They many times involve the safety of the astronaut and how well he's going to be able to endure a given situation, and we look for his input there, and we take it honestly, and I think we trust each other implicitly in that respect.
I believe we have time for one more quick question from one of you gentlemen. Mr. Simmons?
Chris and Chuck, I guess I can call you by your first names after all this time. I think everybody agrees that the country was tremendously bucked up by the performance of Gemini 4. Do you feel that we have more confidence now that we can actually make these tremendous space objectives on our schedule? I'm thinking now of the Apollo objectives of going to the moon by 1970. Do you feel we have a firmer grasp on this now as a result of this one flight?
Yes, I certainly do, Henry. I think that some, well, just looking at it strictly from the medical point of view for a second, I think that this has given us a fair start toward the duration of the Apollo mission. We could indeed do the duration of the Apollo mission on the next flight, which would really be a boon to us and give us a lot of confidence. And I'm sure the same thing is true in Chris's area.
Well, I think we now have a feeling of confidence that our equipment is going to last for the periods of time that we're dealing with, that we've developed the systems that will give us that kind of reliability. On the other hand, I think we found out from this flight that there are many things to be learned in spacecraft flight operations, that we're really babies in this aspect of the thing, that the Gemini program is really going to teach us those many things to be learned. So the equipment is going to get us there. We better learn how to use it, however.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You have been listening to Press Conference USA, a weekly discussion program broadcast by the Voice of America. Our guests today were Christopher Kraft, the flight director for the Gemini space program, and Charles Berry, the flight surgeon for the Gemini 4 flight. The news correspondents were Henry Simmons of Newsweek magazine and Adalbert Beowulf of Die Welt. Your moderator was Rhett Turner. Join us again next week at this time for another unrehearsed discussion on Press Conference USA.